It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The filmmaker behind The Colorado thinks of it as a documentary. The project has some significant differences, though. Two-thirds of the film is a marriage of stunning visuals and original music commissioned from five composers. Filmmaker Murat Eyobolu says there's very little narration by Oscar-nominated Shakespearean actor Mark Rylance, and there are no interviews or talking heads. The New York Times calls it a music-driven eco-documentary. The film surveys the River Basin's history, its cultures, its ecology, the dams, and climate change. Bloomington Normal audiences will have an opportunity to screen the award-winning film and attend a guest lecture by Eyobolu Tuesday, March 6th at Illinois Wesleyan University's Hanson Student Center. The film opens and closes with the human myth of origins.
This is my water. My water. This is my river. My river. We love its water. We love its driftwood. It shall flow forever. When the weather grows hot, it shall rise and overflow its banks. It shall flow forever.
Narrator Mark Rylance and the human myth of origins, which opens and closes the film The Colorado. Filmmaker Murat Eyobolu, why bookend your film with these words?
I think the reason behind that was to give a voice to the indigenous populations that have been there for many millennia. And I looked for traces of oral literature that I could find. And what I was able to find, and I was actually very pleased to find, was a human myth about the Colorado River, and it was transcribed and published in early 20th century and published in a journal in 1908. So that's the reason why I selected that.
And the words are important enough to begin and end the film with?
I think so, because it expresses a very personal connection to the river, and it's also very descriptive of the behavior of the Colorado River, which the water levels varies greatly. Even though it's only just a few lines, I feel like it really captures the essence of the river, as far as I know the river.
The human is an overarching term for any Native American who traditionally lived in the lower Colorado River Valley, in western Arizona, southern California, northern Baja California. For this area and the Native Americans who still live there, the river does not flow forever, does it?
That's right. Over the past few decades, the river is not reaching the delta unless it's an exceptionally wet year. And there have been just a few of those over the past three or four decades. And the reason for that is the water retention in North America, or in the U.S. rather specifically. By agreement, to get into the details a little bit, 10% of any given year's flow goes to Mexico. And of course, Mexico has its own industries, has its own agriculture and cities for which it uses the water. And the delta is tragically desiccated at the moment.
Yes. What's happened to the Colorado River Delta?
Well, the Colorado River Delta, which was a lush, really lush wetland, and its descriptions from the early 20th century are just really unbelievable. Is just a dry area. I mean, there's just some very small amount of vegetation that really grows in those really salty conditions, like salt cedar thickets and things like that. And as you've seen also in the film, it's visually a really stunning area, but just for all the wrong reasons. And I should also mention that there are efforts to rehabilitate parts of the delta. And that effort is led by both some Mexican NGOs as well as the American NGOs, such as the Sonoran Institute and Pro Natura in Mexico. And I've visited those areas. The moment a small amount of water returns, and if it's well managed, it's unbelievable how quickly the habitat recovers, but it takes a lot of effort, and those areas at the moment are rather small areas.
Yeah, the aerial views of the Delta that you've included in your film are stunning. They're very colorful, but it's not vegetation that we're looking at. It's chemical residue and salt and those sorts of things, correct?
Yes, exactly. They often look like abstract paintings and they look very interesting, but actually there's in the area, in the images that we show, there's no vegetation in those areas, and it's largely salt and mineral residues and so on and so forth, as you said.
Murat, what led you to this project? Why a film on the Colorado River?
Well, it was, I have to say, I stumbled upon it a little bit. I was working on a small project in the Salton Sea area, and I started researching that area, which led me to William Dubuis's book, Salt Dreams, which is a social and ecological history of the lower Colorado River Basin. And I felt like there were many stories to tell about that region, and it was a massive cautionary tale. But I wasn't sure what the larger story was to which the Salton Sea story belonged. So while researching that, and working with William Dubuis, we actually have arrived at the story of the Colorado River as a basin.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the ecological disaster that is the Salton Sea in just a moment. Is this a documentary or is it something else?
I think it's a documentary. I think of it as a documentary, except that it has a large musical component to it. Two-thirds of the film is just pure music. Some of it has lyrics. But those parts that have just music and images are strictly contextual. So I think that's what makes it a unique documentary, I think, in the sense that we do get the documentary content, but then we do get to reflect on that documentary content through an immersion in images and music.
Yeah, there's no talking heads, no interviews, precious little narration. As you said, most of the film is music, the images are accompanied by music. It's been described as a film oratorio. What do you think of that description?
Yes, that phrase is used. And I think it's a descriptive phrase. I personally don't like the use of the word oratorio because it connotes a very specific 18th century musical form. And that's, I'm sure, is the music historian in me. I'm a music historian alongside a filmmaker. But I think it captures the sense that it actually a story is told through music and words. And I think that's a fair description for the film.
So music and stunning visuals tell this story. Why take this approach? Why not more a traditional documentary approach?
You know, I think I essentially believe in music, and it's one of my music and images is one of my personal strengths. I think when I look at my own background, I'm originally a trained photographer, and then I studied music history, and I taught at the university level for a number of years, and then I got into filmmaking. So it, in a sense, combines my strengths. And I think that's the best way I can tell a story.
Well, what do you want to say about the composers you chose for this project? And what do you want to say about the music?
I started working with the composers that I had known and I had a working relationship with. And upon discussing with them as to who else should be on the project and so on and so forth, it has been a very organic process of discussing and getting others interested and so on and so forth. But one thing I want to say about the number of composers is that the idea behind that is that the film covers a really broad topic, both geographically and historically. And we didn't want a single musical voice or single character or single voice to dominate that really broad historic time frame. I feel like it worked well, but I let others decide.
Well, let's talk about a specific piece of music. And this particular piece of music accompanies a part of the film about John Wesley Powell, who certainly has a connection to Bloomington Normal. Why was this particular music piece of music important to you?
Well, first of all, the story of John Wesley Powell is entirely central to not only the Colorado River, because he is actually the official explorer of the river and has written a bestseller a number of years after his expedition. But I think I can safely say that the scholarly output and the life and the ideals of John Wesley Powell pretty much stand behind the aspirations of this project, in the sense that he had an holistic vision of the land and the population of the land by people.
Well, let's listen to An Unknown Distance to Run with lyrics by William Dubuis. Music from the Colorado. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy talking with filmmaker Murat Eyyubolu. He gives a guest lecture after the screening of his film, The Colorado, tomorrow at Illinois Wesleyan University. IWU and the Colorado share a connection thanks to John Wesley Powell, who was a professor of geology, among other things, at Illinois Wesleyan and a lecturer at Illinois State University. Let's listen to part of the film again. This is narrator Mark Rylance.
For three centuries after Spaniards first entered the region, the central parts of the Colorado watershed remained a blank spot on the map of America, a terra incognita. This changed in 1869, when Major John Wesley Powell, a one-armed veteran of the Civil War, led a crew of nine men in four boats down the Colorado River from Green River Station in the Wyoming Territory through the Grand Canyon to the Mormon settlements near the mouth of the Virgin River in Nevada. A constantly perilous journey of nearly 1,000 miles. Powell's crew consisted of mountain men and Civil War veterans.
We learned so much from John Wesley Powell's expedition. What do you want to say about Powell and his first expedition?
Well, I think of it as a kind of an American Odyssey, and him is a kind of like Odysseus, because it really is an incredible journey. Like, imagine going down that stretch, especially the Grand Canyon, with these large wood boats, not knowing at all what's ahead of you, and going through these incredible rapids and so on and so forth. So that journey itself is one of the greatest adventure journeys in the history of North America. But then the narrative he created out of it, and the vision of the American West that he created based on his observations and studies of the American West, I think, is what really creates the legacy of John Wesley Powell.
Sure. Powell had an idea about how to manage the land and the river. Again, here's Mark Rylance from your film, The Colorado.
His life's labors culminated in a holistic vision for the settlement of the West, based on what he called watershed commonwealths and a close understanding of the limits of the land. His vision was accurate and prophetic, yet opposition from land speculators and politicians alike ultimately defeated it. Many advocates for the land have looked back on that with regret ever since.
How would these watershed commonwealths have worked?
Well, it would require the West to be settled after it was carefully surveyed, the watershed studied, and then the settlement guided on the basis of those principles and results, the data of the survey.
And of course, settlement occurred more organically than that.
Yes, exactly. So his ideas, even though they would have, I think that the water situation would have been very different if the West had been settled based on the ideas that he had developed. But it kind of flew in the face of people acting independently, and it also conflicted with many real estate interests and so on and so forth. And it was not possible in practical terms to actually apply his principles. In fact, he did lead a survey of watersheds, and I think and that study, that team that was going around, was trailed very closely by real estate speculators and so on and so forth. So it it was very hard to apply his ideas.
How do you think the Colorado River Basin would be different today had we followed Powell's plan?
I think there wouldn't have been the need to create these vast reservoirs. And then perhaps the main river wouldn't have been drained so much, because the settlement as well as the agricultural production would have been, instead of concentrating on few large areas that required huge water diversions, they would have been spread across the existing smaller watersheds. So that's what I think would have been the result of his vision.
And we would have avoided maybe some of the ecological disasters like the Salton Sea?
Most likely, yes. Most likely that would have been avoided as well. You know, to note, the idea of irrigation, doing agriculture with irrigation, is actually, as long as there's infinite water supply, is a brilliant idea. And it worked beautifully for 100 years or so, I think. But now it's like, now that the demand on the water is so much more and the supply is less, so it's a story of declining supply and increasing demand, it doesn't seem sustainable anymore.
How much of the history of the Colorado is intertwined with ecological disaster?
Well, I think the Salton Sea is the most emblematic one, I would say. And in the film, it has a disproportionately large place. There's a section devoted to the Salton Sea, and then the Imperial Valley, where there's a large agricultural empire.
Where we get most of our winter vegetables.
Exactly. Whether we know it or not, we actually eat produce from there. And then I think the second really emblematic story is the Delta. It really is an unbelievable story, how the Delta has been desiccated. You've seen a Kukapa elder towards the end of the film, and she's walking across this really dry desert-like mud flat. Something that's not explained in the film, and I might as well say it right now, is that her name is Inocencia Gonzalez, and she coincidentally happens to be exactly the same age as Hoover Dam. She was born the year that Hoover Dam was finished.
Really?
Yes. So she remembers that very area where she's walking as a wetland, where they used to come fishing and they used to bring their animals to the surrounding hills and so on and so forth. And there she is in her early 80s right now. And walking the same lands, and she was actually talking through that to us. I think I would say that the Delta is definitely the second major ecological disaster that's related to the Colorado River Basin.
While Hoover Dam and Lake Mead is what many people think of first in terms of water storage along the Colorado, There's an equally impressive dam at Glen Canyon, which created Lake Powell. I want to play a section of your film about Glen Canyon, and we'll talk afterwards.
If Powell's visit to Glen Canyon was the first by non-natives, that of David Brower was one of the last that anyone would make for a very long time. Brower, the executive director of the Sierra Club, had just led the campaign to save Echo Park in Dinosaur National Monument from being flooded by a dam. He and his allies had proposed Glen Canyon as an alternate location, but none of them knew what they were giving up. None of them had seen it. When Brower finally came to Glen Canyon, he realized that sacrificing it was the biggest mistake of his life.
The narrator goes on to say, many people don't think of Glen Canyon Dam for the water it stores, but for the treasures it drowned. What did we lose by drowning Glen Canyon?
Well, when Glen Canyon was decided to be the location of Glen Canyon Dam, the area was very little known. It hadn't been traveled much since the expedition of John Wesley Powell. And in fact, if you look at John Wesley Powell's book, he does talk about ruins, settlements, and even like pottery just lying around on the surface of the soil and so on and so forth. Now the dam idea was moved to Glen Canyon because Sierra Club actually had fought the idea of a dam at the Dinosaur National Monument at Echo Park. So that was a successful campaign, and the public did not want a major dam at the Utah-Colorado border at the Echo Park. So an alternative had to be found, and the alternative was the unknown area of Glen Canyon. So when people came to know what they were going to lose at Glen Canyon, that came as a shock, and actually it could no longer be fought. And so then there were all these archaeological expeditions and studies that were done in a really narrow time frame because the dam construction was underway. And I think we cite a figure there. There were over 2,000 sites that were marked and studied by archaeologists, and of course not fully excavated because of the time frame that was due. And so, in a sense, we don't know what we lost. And so there's a significant human heritage there we will not know about for a very long time. Maybe the dam will be removed one day, and then the area will become accessible again. And that's a possibility because the water levels are so low in these giant reservoirs right now that they can be combined technically.
So what's the balance sheet look like in terms of the benefits of water storage and agriculture, juxtaposed with the loss of environment and impact on cultures? What did society lose and gain as a result of damming the Colorado, and are we ahead?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are really large questions.
Those are the questions your film led me to.
That's right. Well, yes. I think what's interesting is how land is perceived. It's perceived as something that can be shaped into a particular human vision. And if you look at it from that angle, that vision actually is realized. And I think there's some point in the movie where it talks about how all the unpredictabilities of the river had been overcome because these two large reservoirs had created these massive bank accounts so that if there actually was a deficit one year, it would balance it. And in fact, if you take a tour of Glen Canyon Dam, that's precisely how they explain it to you. It's like a bank account. If there's a drought, even if it's for several years, there's that huge water source that actually takes you through those dry years and so on. But I think that perhaps like the vision that John Wesley Powell developed, there could have been a vision where settlement is more in tune with the limits of the land. And in fact, that's a term that John Wesley Powell used and a point that he emphasized very much. What are the limits of the land and how can social settlement be realized by being cognizant of those limits?
Has that ever happened anywhere in the history of human development, though?
Well, I think that really the break happens when we come into the industrial era, because native settlements have been there for about 12,000 years,
and they were living within their means.
they were living within their means, and they were farming with floodwaters. They had irrigation ditches that to divert water, but with those means, you probably couldn't have an agricultural empire like the Imperial Valley, for instance. You could sustain your own community. You could farm for yourself. So it's like you could do. You couldn't do, in other words, you couldn't do cash crops, but you could sustain yourself. So it's a very different idea of society, and how to respond to the needs of the industrial era with the kind of population growth that we are seeing there in the large towns. How to reconcile that with the limits of the land is the ultimate question, I think, of today. Because at this point, it no longer is sustainable, the current demand and the supply.
And the world and the American West is facing climate change. How does that affect the future of the West and the overused and overpromised Colorado, which is language from the film?
That's right. Well, the predictions, the climate change predictions, is that the Southwest is going to be hotter and drier, and which means that it's actually is going to need more water. And most of the Colorado River water comes from the snowmelt from the Rocky Mountains, and there's actually less of that. So in a sense, the cities there, for instance, like Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson, and so on and so forth, have already been experiencing the consequences of climate change for a while, and they are developing certain solutions. They are trying to deal with it, and I think they will be kind of exemplary cases from which other parts of the world even are going to learn how to deal with the new realities of a drier world.
In fact, you have a sort of snarky line in your film that says there's going to be a lot more desert, and the people who live along the Colorado, since they're used to it, will like that, right?
That's right.
It's sort of a joke, but a dark joke.
It's a dark joke, yeah. Exactly. There's going to be more desert. But people of the Colorado, they already love the desert because it's actually the Colorado River runs through the desert.
Right. Well, Murat, thanks for your time. We appreciate your time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Filmmaker Murat Eyyubolu via Skype. He'll screen his film, The Colorado, and present a guest lecture Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. at IWU's Hanson Student Center. Following the success of The Colorado, Eyyubolu says his next project will examine the Amazon River Basin. Here's more from the film and narrator Mark Rylance.
Nothing stays the same forever. Death always takes its toll. And climate change, whether within the candle flame span of a human life, or the stony eternities of the great canyons, will accelerate the pace of transformation. The people of the Colorado, however, start with an advantage. They already love the desert. That's good. There's going to be a lot more of it.
An excerpt of the film, The Colorado, showing Tuesday, March 6th at Illinois Wesleyan University's Hanson Student Center. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the stories and interviews you hear on Sound Ideas by visiting WGLT.org. Subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast at our website or at iTunes. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.